What are you afraid of? If you've been walking past this church in this past week, you would have seen that enormous poster outside with this one question on it. What are you afraid of? I wonder what your immediate response was to that question. I expect there are some here tonight whose response was to immediately think of their own personal petty fears. I don't know what yours are, whether it's of the dentist, or of examinations, or of spiders, or something similar. There would have been others, of course, to whom the question would have raised much more intense and personal feelings, that it reminded you of some great anxiety that you bear, for yourself personally, or for someone else that you deeply care for. There would have been others, of course, I'm sure, in this church, to whom it had no response at all. The question seems utterly irrelevant. Why, all fear is a sign of weakness, and life is for living, and I don't think too much about those sort of things. And so you dismissed it, and all fear is to be denied. But fear is a basic human emotion, and it's one which all of us have been conscious of in our lives. It unites us here, men and women, Christian and non-Christian. It's part of our humanity as we sit here tonight. But I want to remove this question from the simply the petty and the personal into an area where I believe that all of us who are open and aware of our world and ourselves ought to have anxiety, that all of us ought to be aware and ought to be concerned. And that is about the future for us corporately and for us individually. Last week, I was shopping in Marylebone High Street. And as I waited in the shop, I had in front of me, who was holding up the queue, and I was waiting rather impatiently behind her, this little old lady. She had a large felt hat, which was pulled down over her ears and practically over her eyes as well. And she held up the whole queue as she told the shop assistant about all her fears of the future, how the world wasn't the same as it was when she was a young person, how it had all gone to pieces and everything had become chaotic, and she ended up by saying, they've let it get so out of control that they don't know what to do any longer. Now, one always expects little old ladies to be saying things like that. Some people almost see it as their role and their purpose in life. But one of the interesting things, the important things today, is it has ceased to be just little old ladies who say that sort of thing. It's also become a thing that's said by aware, intelligent, modern people. It was Harold Urey, a past Nobel Prize winner, who said, I write to make you afraid. I myself am a man who is afraid. All the wise men I know are afraid. Now that fear may be for the future for man corporately, in the face of man's seeming hatred of his world, his rape of its nature, his exploitation of its resources, his careless disregard of its beauty, his constant cry for technological progress. And so ecologists have to now write for us a blueprint for survival. Men speculate about how long we can go on in this way, living in this way. You probably know that song that Garth Hewitt sings. It goes like this. And they say we'll all be dead in 1990 because there'll be no drinking water left at all. But don't let that thought, don't allow that thought to cause you panic, because fresh air to breathe runs out the year before. Or it may be man's fear of his future, not because of man's hatred towards his world, but because of man's hatred towards other men. We've heard something about that tonight in Africa, and we've almost become anesthetized to it. We hear it every day. We read it in the papers. We see it on TV. We've ceased to let it concern us any longer. We just watch it, and we accept man's destructive hatred of one another. The psychiatrist R.D. Lang has calculated that normal men have killed perhaps 100 million of their fellow men in the last 50 years. 100 million. Now, it's in the face of facts like that that a man like Arnold Toynbee has written a book called Surviving the Future. And in that book, he writes this: the human race's prospects of survival were considerably better when we were defenseless against tigers than they are today when we are become defenseless against ourselves. If you're in the habit of listening to Radio 1, then you'll know a new release that has just come out, a single release sung by a group called Bismuth. And they sing this: we're running out of hope. And we're running out of love. And we're running out of everything that I've been dreaming of. And it isn't fair. It isn't fair. We're the only generation that seems to care. Now, it's not only man corporately facing his future who faces it with anxiety and alarm, but it's man personally. It's you and I as individuals. How are you and I going to face our future in such a world? How are you and I going to gain meaning and purpose in our life in a world which seems to be so chaotic and so meaningless? How are you and I going to gain hope and hang on to hope in a world which seems to be so hopeless? How are you going to live and cope with your future, with your suffering, with your life, and with your death? That's what George Bernard Shaw called the ultimate statistic. One out of one dies. Is that just going to close an empty period of life? Is that just going to rub out everything you've ever hoped for, all your ambitions and aspirations, as if there'd never been, and emptied even your life of its value that you may have created? Is that what death is going to be? Oh, modern man is terrified of it. He'll talk about the facts of life almost continuously as long as you don't mention the facts of death. You find people will send bereavement cards to their next-door neighbors because they're frightened to go next door and talk to them. How are we going to cope? Now, I say that those are concerns which ought to make all of us have anxiety, all of us to be concerned. To many people, they lead them into utter despair and hopelessness. I suppose Albert Camus writes for many people as he says this: he who holds hopes for the human condition is a fool. There are many others who seek to escape from it. Why, don't worry yourself by thinking. Forget it. Enjoy yourself in any sort of diversion, as long as you don't have to face the anxiety of your own future and your world. And there are others who will seek almost any irrational means of finding some meaning and hope, whether it's in irrational mysticism or else in astrology. I noticed that this Christmas that Selfridges is able to have a whole section, a whole department of its gift department on the astrology and on the zodiacal signs. If you're like me and can't remember what sign of the zodiac you were born under, you're going to have trouble this Christmas. Now, in the face of all this, what on earth does the Christian faith have to say? Has it got anything to say that could possibly be relevant or applicable to you and I sitting in this church in 1974? Is it bound to be out of date? Is it bound to be so irrelevant that it's just removed to the museum of man's hopes and ideas? Now, I believe it isn't. I believe that the Christian faith speaks with real clarity and relevance to you and I here, in our real situation, that it crosses the hundreds of years, even though it arose in a different culture and background and experience, that it crosses those hundreds of years and it speaks to you and I 2,000 years later in terms which are utterly relevant. Now, I want to lead your attention tonight to the passage which was read to us. You don't need to look it up if you don't want to. It's John chapter 20, verses 19 to 29. Let me place again the situation for you of this story, in case you didn't remember it from our reading. It takes place in a room. It's a room where there are 11 men, 11 disciples of Christ. Judas already has committed suicide, and here are these 11 men left, and they're shut into this room. And then in this room, the risen Christ comes, and he stands in the middle of them. And he stands and he looks at these 11 men, and he speaks to them, his first words to them after the resurrection. Now, why were they in that room? Why were they locked in that room in such a strange way? Well, we're told in verse 19 why they were locked there. They were there, we're told, for fear of the Jews. Now, here was a band of frightened men. Of course, their fears were quite different from yours and mine. But they were nonetheless personal and intense. They feared their future. How were they going to cope in their future now that Christ had gone? How are they going to survive in it? They feared their loneliness. They had had Christ for 3 years present with them. Now, how were they going to stand it on their own? They feared their suffering in their future and their death. How are they going to cope with that? Here they were, a group of men in a room, frightened, terrified, as they looked at their future. And what do you find? You find that the risen Christ, he comes and he stands in the middle of them and he looks at these men, men that he had known, and he says to them these terrific words, such relevant words. He says, "Peace be unto you. Peace be unto you." Now, that's exactly what the disciples needed. Here he's offering them a new peace instead of their fear. He's offering them a new hope instead of their uncertainty. Now, that's just what they needed, and that's just what you and I need. It's just what our world needs. We're living at the time now, in a time of peace and goodwill, Christmas. How our world needs that again, peace. How you and I need it in our own life. And Christ here speaks it to his disciples, and he speaks it to us. Now, I expect there are some at this point who are saying, "Oh, well, that's all very well to talk like that, but isn't this simply escapism? It confirms all my beliefs and fears about the Christian faith." Why, the Christian faith is like this. It says to people, if you can't cope with life, if you've got too many problems, if you have so many hang-ups you can't deal with them yourself, if you're frightened from the future and you need a crutch to lean upon, then come to Christianity and come to the church and come to Christ, and he will help you. And you can turn your back on all your problems and the problems of the world, and you can forget them all and enjoy the Christian faith. Now, isn't that how many people think the Christian faith is? I have no doubt there are people here tonight in this church who think of Christianity in just those terms. Well, I want to tell you that that's not biblical Christianity. And it's certainly not what Christ was talking about when he talked about peace and hope. Because he's not talking about escapism at all. He's talking about quite the reverse. He's not saying that I'm going to take you out of all the problems that you fear. No, what he says to them is that I'm going to give you a new peace and a new hope right in the middle of those problems. Why, this isn't an escape. These 11 men there were going to have to face just the things that they feared in the future. They were going to have to face rejection, all of them. They were going to have to face suffering and mockery. They were going to have to face hard times ahead of them. They were all, probably but one of them, going to have to face the horror of martyrdom. No, Christ isn't saying to you, "Come to me and I'll give you a passport to escape all troubles and you can turn your back on the problems of the world and yourselves." No, he's not saying that at all. He's saying, I want to give you a new peace and a new hope right where you are, in the real world, in the world where you have to cope with these fears and these problems. Now that's what Christ is saying to them. But there will be others in this church tonight who say, oh, well, that sounds marvelous, but isn't it all so unrealistic? It's typical, again, of the Christian faith. You say, whatever problems you've got, whatever difficulties you've got, then come to Christ, and he'll step in, and he'll say peace to you, and you can forget them all. Isn't it marvelous? It's just like a fairy tale, where everything is sad and miserable, and the fairy godmother comes, and she waves her wand, and then everything is back to perfection. It's just like the TV advert which tells you that it doesn't matter how depressed you are, or how ill you are, how rejected you are by society, you only take one of these, or two of these, or you drink a bit of this, or you smell a bit of that, and there you are. You're back where you start. It's marvelous. Now, isn't that exactly what's happening here? That Christ comes into our problems, and he stands there and he says, oh, well, it doesn't matter about the problems. Peace be to you. And it all gets better. No, that's not what Christ is saying at all. He's not talking about an unrealistic peace and hope. He's talking about utter realism here. Because he gives them two rational, open grounds for this new peace and this new hope. Just look at them. Firstly, he gives them the grounds of his love. Now notice what he does. As soon as he says to them, peace be unto you, we're told in verse 20 this, when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. Now why does Christ show them his hands and side? For one simple reason, because they bear fresh wounds. They bear the wounds of his cross. This is not an unrealistic peace Christ is talking about. It's as realistic as the gash in his side and the nailed tears in his hands. It's a peace and a love which God has given, which has cost him that, which led him to give himself for us. It's the sort of love that John talks about later in his life when he writes, this is what love is. It's not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the means by which our sins are forgiven. It's the sort of love that Paul rejoiced in when he said, talked about Christ as he got Christ who loved me and gave himself for me. Now, I know that in our modern society, love has almost been emptied of its meaning. People talk about love meaning anything. They mean sentimentality or romance. They mean liking things or even using people. But when Christ talks about love, he means real love. A love which is practical and realistic. A love in which has been demonstrated in our world, which was costly. A love which has brought peace between God and man, and between man and man. Now that's the ground on which Christ says to them, peace be unto you. That's the ground on which Christ offers them new hope. It's nothing unrealistic. It's the ground of his love. And the second ground you find here is the ground of his life. Why, the person who stands there, the Christ who stands there to show them his love marks of death, is the Christ who is now alive. The Christ who stands there as the risen Lord, the one who has triumphed over life, death, the grave, the one who has shown victory and now is alive. Now, I expect, again, there are some in the church who immediately switch off at that point. You'll say, oh, it's all very well. I've followed up to now, and I think that it's marvelous the way that Christ seems to demonstrate love. And I accept that about his love, but not about his resurrection and his risen life. That's impossible. You can't believe things like that, and you can't expect me to believe it either. It's just too much to believe. I find it impossible. I want to say to you, if you feel that, that you're not alone. Men have always found it almost impossible to believe. It's been incredible to men, and it was to the early disciples. It was so incredible to them that Thomas, who had been with Christ for 3 years and even heard him predict his resurrection, could not believe it. It's impossible, Thomas said. It's common, it seems to me, to picture the disciples as a rather naive, gullible, superstitious band who believed anything that Christ said, who'd swallow anything and believe it. That's just not true. They found as great difficulty believing this as you and I do. They found it just as incredible as you and I do. But they could not disbelieve what they saw. As they saw the empty tomb, as they now saw the risen Christ, and as later they saw their changed lives as his disciples. They weren't men who were seeking to make up a story. They were men who were frightened and disbelieving. But they were men who were forced to come to believe that there was no other explanation. That here is the Christ who stood before them and said to them, "Peace be unto you. I am life. I have victory. I offer you that life, and I offer you that peace and that hope in your own life to take you through both your life and through your death. I've been through them all before. I understand them all before, and I will take you through them." One of the things that happens to us if you live in the centre of London is that very often you get stopped by someone driving who asks you the way somewhere. Now, normally they're pointing in quite the wrong direction and miles away from their destination. And if you've ever been in this situation, you know how difficult it is. You spend your time trying to explain to them how to get there. You tell them about the one-way system and how you can't go down there. And then you go the third right and then the fourth left. And you gradually watch the bewilderment coming all over their face as you're telling them. And then you see them set out and they probably turn first left the wrong way down a one-way street. And you think to yourself, now I wonder how far they're going to get and where they're going to end up. Now, the most loving thing and the safest and surest thing to do, and if I had the time, it would be the safest for them to do, would be to me to say to them, "Well, look here, I'll get in the car with you, and we'll go together, because I've actually been that way before, and I know it." Now, that's exactly what Christ says. He says, "I've been that way before. I've been through life. I've been through the loneliness that you experience. I've been through the frustration you may experience. I've been through the fear. I've been through the isolation. I've been even through the God-forsakenness. And I've been through death into hope, into life. I've done it before. And I want to go with you through it again. And I offer to go alongside you, that we should share it together and go through it with hope and with peace." There used to be an insurance firm that used to have a great advert for its life insurance policies. It used to say, "What will you be worth when you're dead?" It's a good advert for a life insurance policy. It's a good question, too. And Christ said, "I offer you a new hope through death, through life and death. A peace which will take you through both into my life." It's grounded on his life. Now that's what Christ said those many hundreds of years ago to his disciples, to a frightened band of men in that room. He said that to them and he offered that to them. But how could that become real to you and I? in this church so many hundreds of years later? How can it come across those centuries that Christ can say to you personally and to me, peace be unto you? Can that become real? Yes, it can. It can come be real to each one of you in this church in exactly the same way as it did to Thomas. What happened to Thomas, you'll see, is that he moved from doubt into faith. And Christ said to him, verse 27, do not be faithless, but believing. Believe. Trust me, Thomas. It doesn't come by gaining great academic ability. It doesn't come by special interest to special people. It doesn't come by great religious observance. It comes by trusting, by commitment, by submitting to the Lordship of Christ, of our life, and of our obedience. Now that's exactly what Thomas had to do. You notice it, that here as he came to faith, he fell before Christ and he said, my Lord and my God. And he moved from his fear and his doubt into faith, a personal faith in a personal God. You know, that may be your fear just there. There may be some here tonight who are frightened of that. You felt that God has been saying things to you and involved in your life. But every time you face up to God, you get frightened because you don't know what it's going to mean. I'm frightened to open my life to God. He may change it. He may stop me doing the things I want to do. How on earth am I going to keep it up? What on earth will it mean to me? I had someone who came and saw me last week who was exactly in that situation. But God had been obviously speaking to this person, and they were terrified of it, of opening their life to God and submitting to him. What will it mean? But we have to start there. God will show it what it means. He will give us the strength to keep it up. But we do have to start, as Thomas had to start, as we submit to him as my Lord and my God. There may be others in this church tonight who say, well, I'd love that to be true. I know something of the anxiety of myself and my future, and I'd love to know that new peace and hope and to have God's presence with me. And I've been looking for it for ages, but I don't know how to believe. I just don't know how to start. Well, that's what we're here for tonight. We're here to try and help you. If you're in that situation, please stay behind. Don't dash away afterwards. Do stay and talk to us. I'll be down the front here, and I'll love to talk to people who would like to know how it's possible to start. I've got booklets which might help you and explain it more clearly. There's all of us on the staff here who would just love to talk to you about that issue. There are Christians, many around in this church, who would love to share with you. It can be started. You can know it for yourself. It doesn't have to be just a story in a Bible. It can be a story in your life today. That's what we long for. That can be true tonight. That Christ can say to you, peace be unto you. Mary, Peter, John, Margaret, peace be unto you. Let us pray. Lord God, we thank you that you have not left us alone, that you love us and have demonstrated that love, that you live and you offer us that life. And we ask you for each one of us, that we may be open before you, be honest before you, and find that peace and hope which only you can give, for your name's sake. Amen.